Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is Dr. John Stamey. I'd like to welcome everyone to the number one paranormal network. At least we were designated that today by the number one guide because they've looked at a lot of them, and we came out number one. I got a phone call. What more can you say? Welcome to the number one paranormal network, ScaryCast Tuesday. We've got an incredible show with a good friend of ours who's been on several of our shows, and everyone's going to enjoy it. So, and by the way, don't forget 10 p.m. tonight, Clyde Lewis and Ground Zero. There's a link. That's the link pinned to the top of our Facebook page. So don't forget Ground Zero podcast, the number one paranormal podcast in the world, according to four different magazines. So anyway, I'm just excited to be, I just get excited, you know, and I had some great phone calls a little earlier tonight, and it was just so much fun catching up with people that are wonderful, that really kind of like ScaryCast. So anyway, tonight, our co-hosts are, first of all, from somewhere in southwestern Virginia, that's all I can say, is Matt Delph. How are you doing tonight, Matt?
I'm doing good. Excited to hear about these and this ghost stories in my state, Virginia.
Heck yeah. We're glad to have you here. And you and I have been friends for like 6, 7, 8 years, and we've gone through a number of adventures. And so it's wonderful to have you as always. And from Houston, Texas, the guy that the moment I saw him on Facebook Live, I said, he's going to be a scary caster. And he is. Kyler Smith, how you doing?
Doing great. Dude, I keep hearing that intro, and it gets me every time. It's awesome.
Thank you. You know what's funny? The composer that did that has blocked me. I paid him for it, and he's blocked me. I don't know. So I'm going to have to get a new theme music here. But anyway, it's a good theme right now, and we're glad to have everybody on ScaryCast, especially Matt and Kyler. You guys are great. So tonight, from approximately Richmond, Virginia, plus or minus a little bit, the one and only Steve Dills. He is the head of a nonprofit that owns a haunted tavern. He runs a paranormal event, and, I mean, he has been a friend of ScaryCast for about 3 years. So, Steve, welcome to ScaryCast Tuesday. How are you doing?
I am good. How are you guys?
We're glad to have you here. We really are. And first, my first question to you is this. Now, by the way, we've got a new format. We're not an hour and a half. We're like 57 minutes so that we can get out of the way for Clyde Lewis and Ground Zero. Just wanted to remind everybody that. So here's the deal. Tell us about, because you just had your paranormal event up there at the tavern. So tell us all about it, because I wasn't able to be there. And I think our buddy Justin Brannon was there, right?
Yep, Justin was there. We had a whole slew of folks that was there. It was an awesome time. We had our second annual Hanover Tavern Paracon, and 100% of the proceeds, just like all the events that we do, all go towards the historic location that we're working with. So 100% of the proceeds from that event went directly to the Hanover Tavern Foundation, and that goes right back into the building in the form of historic preservation restoration, and it also benefits the local community. One of the big things that the foundation does is we bring in about 3,000 school-aged students every year for field trips, and we teach them about not only Virginian history and local history, but also our country, our nation.
That is a wonderful thing that you folks do. It really is. So now, my first question is this. Exactly what is the town in which the Hanover Tavern is located?
Sure. So it's actually located in the county. So it's in Hanover County, Virginia. And it's right in what would be considered downtown Hanover. So it's at the Hanover County Complex. And it's actually one of the oldest taverns in America. The building itself dates back to 1791 at its earliest piece. However, a tavern operated on the property dating back to about 1733. That's when we know that there was a license to operate the tavern. And so that tavern is important because it sits right in the Hanover County Complex. And by that I mean it would be servicing a courthouse for circuit court as it came through, as well as the clerk of court's office, which is still there. The courthouse is still there. It's the third oldest continuously operating courthouse in America, as well as a jail. And so the jail that we have there dates back to about 1865, and we call it the Old Stone Jail. So our tavern was a really important piece, not only to the county, but it also sat right on the Stagecoach Road between Richmond to Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, which means we saw a lot of pretty notable folks coming through.
Oh, I'm certain of that. And now I'm going to ask a very unpopular question. Are you ready for this, Steve?
Okay.
Okay, you're talking about a tavern where alcohol was and is sold. And I was lectured this past weekend about family-friendly absence of alcohol. And it kind of made me mad because I have a lot of very good friends who have wonderful families, and they don't mind taking a drink.
Yeah.
Now, back in the day, it was okay to have a drink, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much the thing to do when circuit court came into town after a long day of court. It was pretty much commonplace that any of the folks that were there for court, as well as anybody that was like a judge, lawyer, attorney, they all would head over to the tavern, a nearby tavern, for food, drink, and probably to stay the night. Because with circuit court, you typically weren't always near your home. And at that time, travel wasn't as quick as it is today. You couldn't just hop into your car and, you know, bolt down the road. You were taking a horse and carriage, and that took a lot more time.
Right, and I guess my beef with all this, with the saying, you know, it's family friendly, that means no alcohol. Families do drink alcohol, and by the way, I don't know if the people who told me this are listening in tonight. Don't really care, but alcohol has been a part of our culture since Egypt, since they learned how to make beer, correct?
It's been around for a very long time, and in fact, for quite some time, beer and alcohol was actually cleaner than water. And so, you know, people were drinking beer more than water because the water contained a lot of harsh chemicals and things that could make them sick.
Right, and especially like in London, the Thames River was so polluted that they pulled water out of it, brewed beer, which was fairly pure. So anyway, I'm sorry for getting off on that, and I guess that's one of the few privileges of ownership. It's like, you know, I just wanted to say that. Thank you for that. And Matt Dell, I know that you've got some questions for Steve. But first of all, Steve, tell us one of your very great ghost stories because you've got a ton of them in the Hanover tavern.
Yeah. So let's see, ma'am. So the first real reason that we were brought to the tavern, that my team was brought to the tavern, and ultimately that's how I ended up on the board and the president there, was a story about a spirit that we call the Lady in Black. Everybody's got their lady of, or man of, you know, whatever color, but we've got a Lady in Black. However, one of the more recent things that we've been experiencing, we've actually picked up activity quite a bit recently within the last year or two, and that has included more, I guess, frequent full-body apparitions, and some of those actually being doppelgangers of some of our foundation staff. So that's kind of been a very interesting experience. We're not quite sure why that all of a sudden is popping up, but we are having people seeing doppelgangers.
Right, and you've got a very interesting story about the doppelgangers that you guys saw when you were in the new in Hanover. I'm sorry, I keep saying New Hanover because that's the county north of us in Wilmington. But you had seen doppelgangers in the Hanover Tavern, and please remind us of that great story. This is something you told on Scarycast about 2 years ago, the Monday night version.
Yeah, so one of the more interesting, I guess, doppelgangers that we've experienced was actually in the form of our executive director, Dave. And we work with another paranormal team in the area called CPRI. And what they do is, whereas most teams will actively investigate, and by actively I mean they go into a location, they try to make contact with something, they're trying to communicate with somebody, right? They kind of passively investigate. They're looking for environmental data and changes in the environment, right? So they had set up a bunch of equipment, and typically what they'll do is they will leave it overnight at a location. And they did just that. So they left all this equipment overnight. They left a bunch of data loggers, environmental data loggers. I want to say upwards of 16 cameras that evening, maybe even up to 24. And they started, they turned everything on, let it roll. They came back the next morning on Sunday morning and started reviewing, started breaking down all of their equipment. When they did that and went up onto the third floor, they actually saw what looked like our executive director, David. And he was, just literally just standing on the third floor outside of his office. And so what happens is Brad, who is on the team, he says, "Hey, Dave, come over here. Just trying to say hi." And Dave just ignores him and continues to walk down the hall. So he radios down to one of his other teammates, Kenny, and he says, "Hey, Kenny, Dave is heading down the back stairs. Can you grab him so we can, talk and say hi and, talk about what we experienced." When Kenny goes to meet Dave at the bottom of the stairwell, because he was literally standing at the bottom of that stairwell, Dave is not there. And so he starts moving up the steps, and at the top of the steps, he meets Brad. And so Dave is nowhere to be found. So Brad gives me a call, and he's like, "Hey, do you know if Dave is at the tavern today?" And I said, "No, he's not there." And I double-checked, and sure enough, he was at home. And so we don't know what exactly they experienced, but Brad recounts seeing this full-bodied individual that looked exactly like our executive director, down to wearing a T-shirt, jeans, sneakers. Everything was literally exactly what, you know, he would wear. And it was pretty wild. You know, that's not something that they typically run into. It's not something we run into. And that actually was the first of a number of experiences that folks have had at the tavern that revolve around full-body apparitions and doppelgangers.
Wow. You know, that's a great story. And I like the idea that you have seen doppelgangers. They are very, not real. They are very, very real. And have you seen anything like that since the deal with Dave? The doppelganger deal with Dave.
So we have seen doppelganger Dave two, maybe three times now. And it's always been the side glance. It's been very quick. I know the one time that I thought I saw him, we were actually had just locked up the tavern for the night. And, you know, everybody was heading home. And, you know, the tavern, not only, first off, not only are we a historic location that has a museum in it, but we are also a restaurant. We have a full restaurant that operates, restaurant and bar, just like the tavern would have at the time, and a theater. I mean, we've got a slew of things. So we had closed the night down. All of our guests had left, and we were standing outside. I was talking to some of my team members and some of the staff that works there, and we're looking at the building, and we realized that there is somebody standing in one of the doorways. And it was such that this door has a window on it so you can see into the building, right? It's not like a full glass door, but it is partly so you can look through this window. And we saw what looked like a man standing there with white hair and everything. Well, not really white hair, just this blonde that's very similar to our executive director. And so at the time, I didn't think much of it. I thought, this is bad. Somebody is either, stuck into the building and is trying to stay overnight or, you know, whatever. Maybe we locked somebody in. I ended up calling the sheriff's office, and I had one sheriff respond because, you know, I saw somebody in there. I didn't chalk it up immediately to paranormal. I chalked it up to there's somebody in the building. And multiple people saw this individual standing there. So an officer gets there, and immediately he realizes that it's the Hanover Tavern. And I kid you not, he's like, I'm not going in there until I have backup. And I said, why? And he's like, well, you know, everybody on the force knows the tavern as haunted, and you know nobody likes to go in at night. And I said,
nice.
Okay. And so typically, what happens is apparently this is what I've been told by the local sheriff's office that whenever they get a call for like the alarm going off at the tavern, typically it's false alarm. They will always send the new guy because, you know, I guess it's just a rite of passage, but also the other officers and sheriffs don't want to go. And so this guy arrives. He's like, I'm not going in there. I'm waiting. And so we wait and we wait and we wait until there is now, there are probably 11 sheriffs
at the building.
Oh, my God.
And I unlocked the doors, and they went in pairs of two because they refused to go alone to clear the building. And then I had one officer who was, you know, he showed up a little late, and he didn't have a partner, and he's like, well, I'll just wait with you here at the front desk. And I said, okay. So he stood there with me while the rest of the sheriff's office cleared the building. And, of course, they found nothing. But it was just the funniest experience. But, you know, finding out this local kind of folklore. I mean, the building definitely is active. But to have the local sheriff's office, you know, have this mentality and this stigma around the building was pretty funny.
That would have been a prime moment to scare the hell out of all of those officers that showed up.
I feel like that would also be a bad idea.
Well, I'll tell you what, you have had some amazing events happen at the tavern. I mean, I've heard many stories from you over the years on ScaryCast Monday. So now, Matt Delph, do you have a question for our guest?
Okay.
Do you do?
Of course. I've got several, actually. We're going to take a trip down the quantum side here. Okay, I believe a lot of your paranormal activity is where different timelines overlap. So you got certain consciousness in one area. So you've got the past. So, okay, my first thing is these doppelgangers. Okay, are they wearing old clothes or are they wearing the same clothes that the people have there? What is the history on the tavern? Is it across the ley line? And basically, you know, is there anything from the that unexplainable? Like, well, I mean, it's all kind of unexplainable, but is all most of the haunting stuff from the past, or is there anything that's kind of weird that could be futuristic possibly?
All right. That's a lot of questions.
Matt, I'm going to ask you this. State question one for Steve. We're going to do one, two, and three. So what's the first question?
Okay. What is the history and is the of the tavern, and is it across ley lines?
Okay. So the tavern, like I said earlier, has dated back to 1733. So it was a fairly important location. It saw activity during the Revolutionary War. You know, we saw Marquis de Lafayette, Rochambeau, George Washington twice stayed at the tavern. And so it did play a very significant part along the travel for troop movement through Virginia. Being on the Stagecoach Road, it saw countless people in and out of the buildings, whether they were stopping there for you know, a quick stay, or maybe they were there overnight, maybe they were grabbing a bite to eat, maybe they were meeting a loved one. You know, it would have been a location that you probably had a little bit of some emotional tie. Moving a little bit down the line here, it also played a very important part. Let's scoot back to American Revolution still. Patrick Henry actually lived at the Hanover Tavern for a period of time. The Shelton family, and he married Sarah Shelton. The Shelton family, her parents, owned and operated the tavern for a period of time. And while Patrick was here, it was theorized that this is the location that he found his passion and love for law. When he was at the tavern, he played as a fiddler as entertainment, and also as a barboy for the tavern. So, you know, Patrick Henry here is kind of getting his feet wet in law and in practicing law. Fast forward a couple years, and Patrick argues one of his first cases, the Parson's Cause, at the historic courthouse right across the street. And so Parson's Cause, if you remember back to, maybe fourth grade history, you would remember that that is based around taxation without representation. Right? So that is taxation without representation. That is basically the British government demanding tobacco, but it had already been a really bad year, and there was no crop to actually, you know, to give to the British government. They did not have representation, and so a young and ferocious Patrick Henry marches in one day to argue the Parson's cause, and just as luck would have it, this is the very first of a number of cases throughout the colonies, and Patrick argued it so passionately and so well that not only did he win that argument, but he also created a landslide effect. And that meant every other court case went in the same direction, all favoring the colony. And so it is here at the Hanover Tavern, or directly right across the street, that we actually have probably and arguably one of the most important sparks of the American Revolution. So we've got our American Revolution that is really taking place right around us here. Fast forward to the Civil War. The owners of the tavern at that time, Cleavers and Amazilla Chisholm, which is a mouthful. They also went by Anne and Clive. They lived, owned, and operated the tavern during this period of time. And this is where we are in the new tavern now, right? So we're in the 1791-1821 portions of the tavern, which is referred to as the second tavern. During this time, Clive, as he was nicknamed, is actually a Union sympathist. And so the Union Army is aware of this. And as they move through Hanover County, which I would say is you know, probably second to Richmond in one of the most Confederate dense and populated areas in you know, in Virginia, the Union Army is marching through. They have a sick and or wounded soldier that cannot march. And so he is dropped off at the tavern, and he stays there anywhere between 6 to 7 weeks. If you ask him, he says it's 7 weeks. And so he stays there behind enemy lines all alone, and he's essentially stuck. He hides there for 7 weeks until finally the Union Army is marching back through. He's well enough, and he returns back along. So you've got, you know, the Union Army coming through, the Confederate Army coming through, tons of burnings up and down the roads because there's depots for the train. I mean, you've got so much history just packed into this place. Fast forward into the 1950s, you've got the Barksdale Theater, which is a theater troupe coming down from New York, and they find the Hanover Tavern, and luckily they did because it was fairly decrepit and falling apart. But they have a mission, and they open up the very first dinner and a show. So they start restoring the tavern, they open up a restaurant, and then they dig out and open up a theater that seats, I want to say it was 150 people. And it's still there today. They're still there today. They've renamed, they've merged with a few different companies, but they're Virginia Repertory Theater today, still there from the 1950s. So I mean, we've got history, just at least known history, dating back to 1733. We've got owners. We know some of the people that have walked through the doors, including probably, we don't have it for certain, but we know Edgar Allan Poe would have traveled up and down that stagecoach road, so he would have stopped at the tavern at some point. We know P.T. Barnum was there. He stopped on one stormy, rainy night and stayed the night at the tavern. So we've just got tons of different characters and very important historical figures that weave their stories in and out of the taverns.
Wow. Okay. That is incredible. This is Dr. John. I've got a quick question. Do you have a book or a written recounting of these historical figures?
So we don't have a Hanover Tavern-specific book quite yet. It is something that is on the list of things that we want to do for the building and as a way to, you know, bring in money for the nonprofit. One of the things that we do have, however, is a diary of a woman by the name of Margaret White. and Margaret White stayed as a refugee at the Hanover Tavern during the Civil War. She originally lived in Richmond, and as most folks know, during the Civil War in Richmond, if your house was not a hospital, it was probably being used to build something for the war machine, right, the war effort. And so they end up moving up to the Hanover Tavern, and they are staying there as refugees. To make money, Margaret and her husband, John, start folding envelopes so that as soldiers move through the area, if they want to come and write a letter to one of their loved ones, they can purchase an envelope from Margaret or John. One of the things that Margaret starts doing, which is so very important to us, is she starts keeping a diary. And so Margaret is writing all about what's going on. She actually recounts in her diary that she wishes she would have started it sooner. But she also opens up some really great observations. For example, we know that at the beginning of the war, something like, I think it was sugar. I can't remember exactly. But it was like $1. And 1865, just a few years later, that same item, that same object, cost somewhere upwards of $12,000. And that is just raw inflation. She writes about the movement of troops. She writes about the Hanover train depot being burnt like three times. She also writes about our soldier, our Union soldier that's staying there. She writes about the outbreaks of diphtheria in the area. And it was so prevalent that actually the Hanover Tavern, a portion of it at least, was quarantined for a period of time. And she actually writes about one of these patients, this young woman who contracted diphtheria. And if you don't know what diphtheria is, it's basically this disease that will start restricting your throat to the point that your windpipe closes, you can no longer breathe, and you suffocate. And in Margaret's writing, we learn that while she was trying to take care of the sick that were there, one of the women that passes away, her last words are, "I'm choking to death." So we have this diary, this amazing insight into the building, into the ongoings and daily, kind of daily activities of the folks during this three-year period that is just absolutely astounding. It gives us a lot of insight into the war, into the community, how people felt, how they, their own political beliefs and opinions on everything. But that's one of these things that was very important to us early on, to the point that we actually published it. It is available at the Hanover Tavern. It's called The Diary of Margaret White. It's actually available on Amazon as well, but if you do purchase it from the tavern, it actually supports and benefits us much more greatly.
All right, well, that's great. Now, Matt, did that come close to answering your question?
Yeah, see, what I'm trying to figure out is why this place is haunted. So we got a lot of death. You know, if it's cross ley lines, you usually have a lot of paranormal activity, strange stuff. It all configures around ley lines, the energy grid, the earth. Now, so we have all this death and stuff from the wars and stuff going through. Now, are these doppelgangers, are they wearing old clothes? Are they identical to the person? Same clothes, same everything.
So the ones that we have seen tend to be wearing pretty on point clothing with current times. Now this in particular story that I shared, David was not at the tavern, and so we don't have a description of what he was wearing that Sunday to say, okay, are the clothes that Dave was wearing at home the same as the clothes that the doppelganger that was seen at 11 a.m. wearing, right? So we don't have that. What we do know is that clothing that the doppelganger was wearing on that day is consistent with today. Like, it would be something that you could see Dave walking around and wearing. You know, it was a t-shirt, jeans, just, you know, blue jeans, and some sneakers, which is what he would be wearing, you know, on a normal day-to-day basis.
Okay. So that brings up, see, the timeline overlaps for consciousness. So, okay. I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
No, I was saying please continue, man.
Although
Matt, I'm going to have to interrupt you because it's the bottom of the hour. We want to thank Transamerica, the life insurance company that you keep, for sponsoring Scarycast Tuesday. Thanks, Transamerica. Thanks, the Myrtle Beach office, Tammy McClellan, general manager, and we're glad to have you with us tonight. Matt, back to you.
Okay. So that kind of answers a little bit about the timeline. So now, have they had any other, you know, weird activity around there? Any, like, orbs, lights, odor change, different temperature, all that good stuff?
Yeah. We have had almost all that good stuff. tons of orbs, but, you know, for me, orbs are one of those things that I personally, I don't quite count, I guess, as paranormal. Just knowing that, you know, most of the time when we're seeing orbs, you first have to rule it out as potentially being dust or a bug or mold, mildew, like literally anything in the air. So, you know, I tend to stay away from those, but we have had phantom smells. One of the most prominent, actually, the very same hallway that we tend to see most of our full body apparitions and this one particular experience with this doppelganger, is the very same hallway that we also experienced the scent of cigar smell and also perfume. Being a historic location, we are pretty much a tinderbox, so we don't allow open flames. So having a cigar smell somewhere upstairs where we don't allow anybody to, you know, have a cigar lit up there, and our foundation members, actually our staff, where this is the office space, none of them smoke. So there would be no sense for cigar smell or a very strong perfume in the area. We've also recorded footsteps, tons of talking, sounds of doors opening and closing, glass crashing to the ground that scared the ever-living hell out of me because I thought I was about to replace something. I mean, just the whole gamut. One of my two favorite experiences that we've recorded that nobody was interacting with is just things that occurred, anomalous behavior. In one of these instances, we actually recorded on camera these candles turning on. They were electric candles, and you had to twist them at the very bottom on the base. You had to twist them so that they would turn on. And this particular room that this event occurred in is what we call our escape room. We have an escape room that we run in the tavern, and we, you know, utilize this idea as a fundraising opportunity. The room originally was the dining room for the tavern home, which dates back to 1791. At the time, the escape room was decorated in a Victorian era. And so, you know, there's tons of things, tons of candles. You know, it makes sense for Victorian era decor. And we record on camera in the middle of the day. It was like 1 or 2 p.m. We record one by one in an 8-minute window all 10 or 12 of the candles that are in this room turn on. And the interesting thing about it is they don't just turn on randomly. It's not like one turns on, then one over here turns on. It's as if something was moving through the room in a counterclockwise direction, which means they walked into the room, they turned on a candle, or lit, you know, quote-unquote, a candle that was directly next to the door, and then they moved towards the windows, and they lit the candles in the windows. And then there was a candle on one of the desks, and then that was lit up. And then there was one over that was next to a bed, and that was lit up, and then these other two near a wash basin. And so they lit up in a very particular pattern that would make sense and kind of align with somebody that was walking through the room, lighting the room up in the evening. And so that was really interesting because We were able to record that on not one, but three security cameras. So we can prove nobody was in the room. We can prove nobody had been in the room for almost 24 hours at that point. And we have all these great different angles of this experience. One of the others that I really like is from the other team that we work with, CPRI, and they have on DVR where their data logging equipment. So they have data loggers of various brands, as well as a laptop that was recording data one by one, again, in a sequential order throughout the tavern as if somebody is walking through, turning off their equipment, literally shutting it off. And so, I'm talking about actual scientific equipment here, not just something that you can walk over and press a button or the battery dies or something like that. We're looking at Geiger counters, GQ, the EDMI Plus, they had a few of those. The laptop was plugged in, so there's no reason for it to shut off. But it's just really interesting because that would indicate the idea of some sort of intelligent activity. So, to answer your question, we have had the whole gamut.
Okay. It's embodied voices. Is it the same? Is it kids? Is it children? Is it the same? Or does it sound like old English? Or can you describe some of it?
Sure. So most of what we've recorded so far, at least that I'm aware of, is English. Now, we do host public investigations, as well as, we do allow other paranormal teams to rent out the building for the night to investigate. Sometimes they don't always get me, what they found, which stinks because I like to keep a record of everything. But everything that we have recorded that I'm aware of so far tends to English. We have recorded like dialects of English where it does sound a little bit older versus today's, I guess moniker and maybe slang and all that sort of stuff. But typically English, some of it does and can sound a little bit older. We have recorded females. We've recorded children. Typically, it's what sounds like a younger girl. And that, it tends to sound the same, but it's really hard to say, because, when I'm listening to this and even trying to compare it, sometimes it does sound the same, but it might not necessarily be the same. Do you know what I mean? We've had male. I mean, it's been the whole slew. There is some that tends to be very similar. I know that we have run into conversations with what seems to be the same entity on multiple occasions. And again, in that instance, it does sound the same, right? The EVP that we're recording, if you were to match it up, does sound very similar. The pitch is very similar if you're looking at it visually, those sorts of things.
Good deal.
Well, that's great questions and great answers. Kyler, do you have a question for Steve?
Well, you talk about all the scientific equipment going off and turn off, and also mentioned like one of the moments that you guys had recorded where no one's been in the building for like at least 24 hours, but yet the lights were lighting up. And I'm kind of just, when it comes to stuff like that, I personally am a little skeptical because I know how easy it is to manipulate video recordings and sounds and stuff like that over technology now. Like, our deep fakes are ridiculously insane. You can be anybody. So is there like a procedure that you guys have or a way that you guys can, I guess, well, see, that's the other question too, is you're not really necessarily trying to push it to prove like this is what happened. You're just putting it out there like this is what we saw. So I guess, like, how do you go at this?
So you're correct. And that's why even for me it's so hard to look at somebody else's data or somebody else's video and say, could this be faked? The other thing you run into is when you're doing you know, if you're doing these investigations, typically, I know for me and my entire team, this is a hobby, right? And as a hobby, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have the highest level of video cameras and camcorders and you know those sorts of equipment, right?
Right.
So sometimes the videos you're looking at, you're like, Jesus, this was filmed with a potato, you know, like this looks like it's, you know, 360 or 320, or you know, just the world's crappiest resolution, and you're not sure if you're looking at a tree or what. So it is very difficult to prove these things, and that's something that we've actually struggled with for years, is how do we showcase data in such a way, at least that we can say, hey, you know, we're not faking anything. Like, this is legitimately happening. And we found that it's very difficult to do that. So, for example, the video of the candles, we don't have that publicly available. I like to share it and tell people about it. I will share it privately so you can check it out. But it's actually from an escape room that it was active. That escape room, active in the sense that, you know, the escape room itself was operating for, you know, over a year. And this occurred on, like, month three. So if we share the video out and we're like, hey, look at all this activity that's going on, we're also sharing out the entire escape room. So we couldn't say do that, because then people wouldn't come to the escape room. So, you know, we'll talk about it, but we don't publish it. It's not something that I guess I'm still in this to prove it to myself, and I can't fathom trying to prove to somebody else something that I'm not 100% on anyways. With CPRI, I have, you know, again, it's a personal thing. I've worked with them for quite some time. I've seen the level of effort that they go through. They have published scientific documents with a number of doctors holding PhDs on their team. So you know, I think that offers a level of credibility. I guess for these two in particular, we're not, like you said, putting it out there to prove a point. This is for our own documentation, for our own understanding, for our own research. I'm not, you know, I guess I'm not here to be like, hey, look at this. How entertaining is this? I want to actually find an answer, you know. So publishing little tidbits, I guess, isn't really the goal or the aim. It's more of, let's collect some data. Now let's compare it, and what can we figure out from this? You know, is this something that is tied to our own physics? And I think very early on in the show, you guys had mentioned, you know, quantum mechanics or the idea of a multiverse. You know, the probability to me, I think, is I like that idea, but you got to prove it.
Well, I see what you're saying. And Kyler, thanks for those questions. Steve, this is Dr. John. I've got a very important question for you. For two years, I worked with Dr. Sally Ryan Feather at the Ryan Research Institute in Durham, and she asked me to help her read some letters from people about their paranormal experiences. And she told me her hard and fast rule was, if someone took the time to write you a letter, to put a stamp on it and send it to you, then there's a high likelihood that it's real, that it's legitimate. Now, do you have many people that report experiences to you folks by mail? I know that sounds like an odd question, but that seemed to be a very important thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll have quite a few folks that will reach out through various methods. Most of the time we're seeing messages like through Facebook or Instagram. And kind of like you said, it's one of those things where it's very simple to just reach out and type up a couple sentences of something that you may or may not be experiencing. And that's something that we take very heavily when we're looking at bringing on a client case, right? Trying to assist somebody in their home, in their residence. The way that, you know, we don't have like a mailing address per se, but I think what would most relate to it is we have a fairly rigorous form. We have, you know, we used to have an intake request where it was just contact one of us somehow. And that was fine and dandy, but we ran into a number of experiences where, in particular, one of my favorites, we went out to this client's home, and she had been claiming that she was experiencing tons of activity and you know, needed somebody immediately. We show up, knock on the door, she opens the door, we walk in, and we notice that there are three or four other ladies sitting at their dining room table in their kitchen. And they're enjoying a glass of wine. And, you know, I said, you know, hey, you know, how's it going? You know, we're here to investigate. And she's like, yeah. So, you know, that's great. You can put your stuff down over there. Do you know what time the cameras are going to arrive? And I said, you know, cameras, what are you talking about? She's like, for filming, you guys are filming this for TV, right? And so, you know, we immediately realized that, oh, man, the only reason that we were asked to be here was so that this woman could get, you know, some sort of fame. And after that, we had to really evaluate how we interviewed clients, how we, you know, approved and brought on cases. And so today, to kind of, I guess, streamline the process, but also make it something that, like you said, somebody's taking the time out of their, you know, their day. This is actually legitimate. Somebody legitimately needs help. We have an online form, and we request some, you know, some pretty, not necessarily intense, but some very specific data that, you know, if you're going to fill this out, if you're going to take the time to actually fill out this form and request our assistance, hopefully there is some validity to this and you're not just trying to pull our leg.
Exactly. All right, well, look, thanks. That's a great answer. And by the way, we have Justin Brannon with us from Richmond. He's got a question. And, Justin, we got time for your question, and then we can say sayonara to Steve Dills. He's been a wonderful guest. Justin, what is your question for Steve?
Hey, Steve. How you doing, man?
How's it going, man?
I'm doing great, bro. Hey, I have a video on my phone from the last investigation on Saturday. I was with Melody and Nallie Jones, and we literally asked the same question: is Bigfoot a demon? Is Bigfoot a demon? Three times, and it came, and I was recording it on my phone and on my camera, and I can send it to you if you need me to. And I said, yes, yes, yes. And then the last video said, Bigfoot is demon.
So, yeah, Natalie was telling me about that.
I'm going to send that to you. That was a... I'm not too sure how that video... I'm not sure, like... what was coming through, but hey, but you know me, I came to the Hanover Tavern 6 times in the past 2 years since 2020. Each and every investigation was different. This one was, I say this past one, it was very, very different, especially in the courthouse.
Mm-hmm. I think like you said, the courthouse is really cool. We actually had Ron Iacovetti and Lourdes Gonzalez join us for the Paracon.
Yep.
And they you know, they're very, very deep into ITC research in the paranormal. And we had them set up an experiment in the courthouse for the entirety of the evening that related around something that they both had designed called the Digital Seance.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they pump white noise through a number of synthesizers and apps that only Ron could probably ever describe. And through that white noise, they were getting clear, audible responses that were direct to the questions that were being asked. It was very, very interesting.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve. Hey,
yeah.
Stephen. Hey, Stephen John. Would you like me to send you the? Would you like me to send you that video that I sent to Melody Knapp?
Yeah.
Well, I would, Dr. John, and
okay.
Absolutely. And I'll pass that by Robin McCray for Scary Cast Monday.
I will,
by the way,
I will send that video to you, even though it's 18 seconds. I was in the courthouse, I was doing multiple videos of less than 30 seconds. That way I can sit back and I can listen to the audio, because that's what I usually do. Sit back, listen to the audio. There's some investigation. I'll come home with 200 photos and 180 videos. But yeah, that was a frequent one when I was listening to that. That one gave me chills up my spine. I was like, oh my God, I want to go back to Hanover Tavern and do that again.
That's something I want to say to Steve. Steve, I want to thank you for being on ScaryCast Tuesday, and I want to talk to you later about bringing the ScaryCast team up there with Matt Delph and some of the other folks, and we'll invite Justin Brannon. And we'll have a wonderful time up there with you. So I'll talk with you about that very soon. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
All right. And I want to remind everybody, be sure to listen to the one, the only Clyde Lewis for Ground Zero, the number one paranormal podcast in the world, because you are listening to right now the number one paranormal network in America. So anyway, thanks a lot to everybody. We'll see you next week. Matt, Tyler, will you be back with us?
You know it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, great. And look, thanks a lot. And we'll, oh my goodness.
And
dude.
John, you know. And John.
Pardon?
And John, you know I'll be back next week.
Sure, we'd love to have you. That'd be great. So, look, thanks to everybody.
Of course.
We're glad you're all here. We got to get out of here because Clyde Lewis is coming up. So listen to him, number one Clyde Lewis on ScaryCast. And thanks a lot, and we'll see everybody next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.